As the children are exiting, I'd like to read our text again. I like to read the text because it gets me back into the spirit of things. Gets my mind locked back in. So if you will, turn back to 1 Peter. Chapter 2. Let's go back to verse 11 this time. 1 Peter 2:11, beloved. It's a strong word that we don't often use when we're talking about the church. A lot of times we have our problems and issues in the church. And it's easy to leave that little piece off. Peter does not. Beloved, those I love, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. May they be forced, if you will, to recognize the excellent behavior that you walked in when the Lord comes. They'll have to admit that. Verse 13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now he gets into our citizenship here on earth and what that entails. This is where it gets sticky, of course. He says, whether to a king as one in authority or governors is sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. We talked last week a little bit about this and just about Caesar and Pilate and Herod and the various people that the people to whom Peter is writing would have found themselves under the thumb of, and yet they are told to submit to them, not resist, not start a rebellion, or any other such thing. And it's interesting to consider, had Israel listened to God on this in the Old Testament, what might be different? What might be different? Had they listened when Jeremiah pled with the people of Israel, don't rebel, what might have changed? I don't know. What might have changed had they listened to Peter here, had the zealots in the land of Israel listened to Peter here and not started a revolt that caused the Romans to come over and decimate Palestine, export the people of Israel? What might have been different? See, they thought it was right to start an insurrection because Caesar is not one to whom we should bow. He's a bad guy. He claims to be a god. There's no way we're going to do this. He continues in verse 15. He says, for such is the will of God that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Now, he picks up that theme in the text we're going to look at today, but he lays the seeds for it now. And then says, act as free men. And do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people. Honor all people. Even those you can't stand. Even those who you know are wrong. It's hard sometimes there, isn't it? So and I watched a show the other day, and I walked in the room at a particular point, and there was a person who was clearly and adamantly against God. And all I could think was, why do you let him live, Lord? Right? Why does God let the Richard Dawkins type people who thumb their nose at him, why does he let them live? Because he's gracious beyond understanding, merciful beyond compare. Honor all people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. So with that staccato series of statements there, he just lays that to us, brings the wood to you right there. Really, if you just listen to that, your problems are solved, right? But because we're thick-headed, we need elaboration. It's not enough to just hear that. We need to hear why, because I don't want to do that. I struggle with honoring all people, loving the brotherhood, fearing God, and honoring the king. So then he continues, and now he gets even more in your kitchen. He started with being a citizen, for example, as being like an American citizen. Now he continues talking about being a servant. Verse 18, servants, Be submissive to your masters with all respect. With all respect. Not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. Think about it for just a moment. How often do you really need to submit, truly submit, to the good and reasonable, nice guy master? Doesn't happen much, does it? Because he's reasonable. You can talk to him. You can discuss issues with him. Instead, where we often have to come to terms with the idea of submission is when we disagree. If you agree with people, that's not really submission. That's just agreeing with them, going along with their plan. Be submissive to your masters with all respect. Verse 19, for this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if, when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? If you've done something bad and you get a beating for it, and then you're patient about it, so what? That's what he's talking about. Talking to slaves who have no rights. He says, but if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. All kinds of illustrations should be popping up in your head. Think of Joseph in the Old Testament. Right? There's many things that could pop. Think of Cain and Abel. Think of Abel, rather, not Cain. Verse 21, for you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, and while being reviled, he did not revile in return. And while suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. And as Johnny pointed out in his prayer, and that's why we're here, isn't it? For you were continually straying like sheep. Just another reminder of why Christ had to die for us. Because you were continually straying. Ever watch a... I don't have any personal on-hand experience with sheep. Probably most of you don't either. Some of you do, I'm sure. Have you ever watched something on them? Watch a special? I do, just because we're compared to sheep in the Bible. So whenever I see like some kind of National Geographic thing or whatever it is, and they got sheep involved, and I want to see it because I want to see how they are. Man, they're stupid, aren't they? They're totally fine in their little pasture, and their shepherd has hemmed them in a fence of protection. They're so like us because we're taken care of, but we're like, yeah, but this isn't good enough. I need something more. I need to go outside of this fence. I need to find something else. What I have, what has been supplied, nah, not so good. What's over there, though, now that looks fantastic. How crazy we are. How bizarre we are. We were continually straying like sheep, so therefore we needed a shepherd and a guardian for our souls. And he came. Hallelujah. The question that I come to as I approach this, after reading about being a proper citizen in this world, and then reading about being a submissive servant, we'll get into that in a second. The thing that I come to, the thing that I wrestle with is, how can I be a submissive servant in all respects? Because I don't see that in me. Do you? See, consider the rebellion that rises up in you so often. And if you're paying attention to yourself, you'll see it. When you're a child, it's easy because mom says no and you say yes. Right? When you get older, you get more sophisticated. We're just sophisticated children, aren't we? We don't think about it often, but how often are you, when you know you get in the car and you need to put on your seatbelt, how often do you go, nah, I don't feel like it? I do it. And then I have a kid in the back seat going, Dad, where's your seatbelt? You're like, law comes in, and then I'm aware of rebellion. I just heard this last week, just yesterday actually, that Hillary Clinton is one of the things she has let slip a few times, I guess. I don't know how accurate this is, but that she is all for the idea of mandatory government buyout of guns. That she says she's going to present that position whenever she can. She's talking about confiscation of weapons. I have a kind of fundamental problem with that. I think that goes against a basic right and kind of an amendment that we have at a governing issue here in our country, right? But what am I going to do? What am I going to do if she gets in office, which could very likely happen, and she enacts such laws? What are we going to do? Will I be a submissive person then? See, we have some hard issues to face. The people that Peter is writing to are facing a much greater injustice than the confiscation of weapons. They will be dragged away and killed for what? For a misunderstanding about who they are and what they believe. They have every reason to, humanly speaking, rebel and stand up for their rights. As I look at this and I see the rebellion that is within me on so many issues, I wonder, how can someone like me, a chief of sinners, I like to argue with Paul on that. I don't know about you, but when Paul calls himself the chief of sinners, I'm like, Paul can only say that because I wasn't born yet. He didn't know me. How can I be a submissive servant, one who is fully aware that no good thing dwells in me? How can I get there? Because I don't see it. I'm proud and independent and clearly weak, but I would say this. This is exactly the gateway you need to pass through in order to attain victory. You must recognize weakness, that you are but dust, animated dust. Jar of clay. The more little understanding of that jar of clay verse that we know is baked dirt. I like that better. I'm just cooked dirt. How can I get there? How can I live righteously like this? Like I'm like Paul, like Peter rather, asked me to live. When I recognize how very weak and needy I am, this is the gateway. When I see the need to die, then I live. When I see the need to die to self, then I live. What stands in the way of me and you being submissive servants? In a word, self-confidence. That's creeped into our systems, hasn't it, as Christians? Well, you got to be self-confident. Do you? Why would you be self-confident? What good thing dwells within you, as I said earlier? Are you aware of your sin nature? Are you aware of how wicked you really are? How far you fall short of the glory of God? Are you aware that you could be the worst of the worst in society? Or do you think, no, I wouldn't do that? Do you see these mass shootings and think, I would never? Yes, you would. Yes, you would. There is the restraining grace of God that keeps you from being that. I would do that. And it's weird to look at our, and it's understandable in a sense to look at our society, and what do they do when there's a mass shooting? They always look, what's wrong with them? What fundamental thing is wrong with them? Because no normal person would do that. Why do they look for that? Because they want to feel safe. Normal people don't do those things. Yes, they do. Yeah, they do. Of course, they're deranged as they go and do that. But normal people get there. Every crackhead, every prostitute didn't start life that way. They had no intention of ending up in the gutter where they are. You have every bit as much potential to being there. So do I. So when I look at me, and I look at what obstructs me from being what I ought to be. It's this goofy sense of self-confidence, this pride that manifests itself in this belief that I can do this. I can overcome, as he said back in verse 11, this abstaining from fleshly lust. I can do that myself. I can achieve that. No, you can't. In yourself, you cannot do that. Were you born by your own power? Were you out there in the cosmos and thought, I'd like to be born now? Did you have any input into your coming into this world? Do you think you had any more input into your rebirth? I think that's Jesus' whole point in John 3 when he's talking to Nicodemus. What control do you have over being born? What control do you have over being reborn? How much control do you think you are exercising in your growth? You were not born by your own power, you were not reborn by your own power, and you are not going to be perfected by your own power, but by the Spirit and by grace. When you recognize that you will be perfected in such a manner as I said, you will recognize how weak you are, how wrong you are, how foolish you are. And as a result, you will eagerly listen to the Lord. Humility comes in. Humility comes in. And it says, I will listen. This is the advantage of doing biblical counseling here at our church. You have people that come in that are at their end. Perfect. You've given up the facade that you can fix it. How about you let God fix it? Now you're ready to listen because you're broken. When you're broken, when you've reached the end of you, that's when growth happens. That's when strength comes in. You will eagerly listen to what he has to say when you come to the end of some misunderstanding about how confident you should be in yourself. We all know this principle. That is that you can't teach someone who thinks they know everything. You ever try to teach a child how to throw a ball? I didn't know how hard this was. To try to teach a child how to throw a baseball and throw it right. Now, I've been in youth ministry for a long time, and I've seen a lot of young men come through, and a lot of them, when I was a kid, especially in Chatham, baseball was such a big deal, that you had to throw a baseball or you like get beat up, and people laugh at you. And so I've recognized myself, I don't want them to get laughed at for just how they throw a ball, so let's show you how to throw a ball. I didn't know how hard it was to work out what I call the T-Rex syndrome. When they throw, they'll do this, I'll get them the arm back, but then what do? They bring it in, they do this. What is that? Stop T-Rexing it, son. I'm like, what do you mean? So you're trying to teach them how to throw and trying to get that arm out. So I've watched videos, I can't get it out. Can't get it out of their system. And you know what stops them from learning from me? Not just the mechanics. Like, yeah, I got it, Dad, I got it. You are 5. You've got nothing. You've figured out squat in life. You don't have it figured out. That's why you're doing this. But you think you're throwing like Roger Clemens. What is that? That is someone who is confident in themselves that they know how to do it. You got to drop all that on the ground and listen. Like, I know nothing. Okay, I'll listen to what you say. That's what we need. That's the childlike faith we come to God with, right? There it is. Drop the facade. Drop the nonsense like you know what you're doing and say, no, I don't, clearly. Clearly, I don't. I don't know what I'm doing with disciplining my kids. I don't know what I'm doing with this issue, that issue, and the other. I need God's wisdom. I need to go back to Proverbs 3, 5 through 7. I need to order all my ways according to what he says. Everything. Invasive into all the areas of my life. Relationships, finances, work. we have this self-confidence that blocks the way to us being what we ought to be. You were meant to be a dependent person, constantly tethered to and dependent upon God. That's what sin is. It breaks that dependence, doesn't it? It's what happened in the garden. It was broken. The fellowship was broken. You were meant to be totally dependent upon God, constantly entrusting yourself, as we see Jesus does, to the Father. Meant to be that. Submissive servants, in the end, summing that up, submissive servants don't trust themselves. They trust their master. I don't know what I'm doing, but I know my master does. And interestingly enough, speaking of servants, verse 18, he says, servants. Now, before I move on even from that single word, there's an interesting thing that's happening here. In their world, much of the world at this time, up to 50% of the population of the Roman Empire are slaves. In their economy, in their way of thinking, a slave was not a human. Therefore, all rights and issues did not apply to them. All laws and agreements don't apply to them. Aristotle, the great mind, said that there is no injustice that can be done to a slave because they are not human. They're subhuman. There's a long history of humanity relegating certain pockets of society to being non-human. We know, of course, of Hitler. But we do that in our country too, don't we? What do you think calling a baby a fetus is for? What do you think that's for? They're not human. What? On what planet? They're obviously human. Nah. It's inconvenient. I don't want to deal with that. That's exactly what they had going on then. And the fact that Peter addresses specifically servants is shocking. And we blow right by it because, you know, that's not us. And we usually connect this directly with the boss-employee issue. And that's an okay thing to make, okay, or even a good association to make, but not entirely. This is much worse. Your boss doesn't think you're less than human, doesn't treat you like a snail. He recognizes you're human. He or she does that. But wherever the gospel goes, everything changes. The status of women always improves where Christianity goes. The ancient world and Jewish society, women were not even considered in a court of law as valuable witnesses. That's one reason why it's so incredible that the first person to whom Jesus reveals himself in his risen body is who? A woman. Quite interesting. The status of slaves, the status of women, the status of children, all these things rise with the gospel. Peter's not looking across at them and looking down on them. Instead, what he's saying is you need to honor all people. So now he demonstrates it. How far do we honor all people? Even to the slaves, the people you think aren't human. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, complete respect, an unbroken relationship with them where the respect never stops. As I said earlier, a lot of times what we do here is we connect this very quickly to us as employees with a boss and things of that nature. And that's okay, but that's not a good way to understand this. We're reading someone else's mail, right? Peter wrote this letter to a group of churches and people, and that's his mail to them, and we're jumping in on that. So we've got to figure out what it meant to them before we figure out what it means to us. And what it meant to them is different in that the nature of the relationship between boss and employee and master and servant is very different. See, with a master, you had no choice. This is a lifetime commitment. If your boss is a jerk, just leave. Get a new job. Maybe you think, well, that'll mess up my finance. That's not what their problem was. You're talking about death. You've got a first world problem. That's not what they were facing. So while this does apply to us secondarily, it's not direct here. Because the nature of the relationship between a master and a servant is very different, being that they could kill you if they felt like it with no consequence. They could beat you if they felt like it. That's what he says here. That's what he says here in verse 20. When he says, "For what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated," right there, "receive a beating," is the idea here, "and you endure it with patience." What credit is it? There's no credit for that. You stole some bread, so you get a beating, and you patiently endure it. So what? You did something wrong. But he says something that intensifies all of this, of course. He says back in verse 18, "But also, they don't submit just to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable." We all have people in our lives that are unreasonable. And all of us are unreasonable at times. How reasonable are you once you get your mind and your will fixed on something? Once you've decided, "I'm going to buy this thing, I'm going to do this thing," how easy is it to govern you in another direction? What an incredible thing to drop in our laps. Submit to those who are even unreasonable. Why? Because this finds favor with God. What we get into in a difficult sentence here in verse 19 and 20 is that God is pleased with innocent people suffering. Doesn't that sound wrong? That sounds wrong. Why would God like innocence to suffer? Innocent people, innocent children of His, rather, even, to suffer. Well, the text here would show us, because, as in verse 21 says, that it's Christ-like. And whenever we act like Christ, that pleases God. And I get that. I know that. But what I'm asking is more lower than that, I guess you could say. I'm asking why God is pleased. Why does that make Him happy? Now think about the things that make you happy. Do you like it when your kid suffers? I mean, your kid's out on the playground and he's being mistreated by some other kid. Are you sitting there like, wonderful. I love that. Love seeing my grandkid pushed over for no reason at all. Makes me feel warm. No! It sounds wrong. Why would He do this? Why would this delight Him? Two reasons. Number one, because God's not after your comfort. He's after His glory. We get this all messed up, and if it's not comfortable for me, it must be wrong. If it doesn't make me feel good, it must be bad. Why would God delight in this? Because He's after His glory, not your comfort. You're not the center of His universe. You ever think about that? You ever just sit there and think about that? He's got 7 billion people on this planet. And we think your problem, I think my little problem, my little hangnail of an issue is like, "God, this needs to be the center of your world right now." God's not after our comfort. He is after His glory. As He says in Isaiah 42:8, "I am the Lord, that is my name, and I will not give my glory to another." Love that. He says over and over again in various prophetic texts, "I will act according to my name. I will perform as I say I will because of my great name." God's not that worried about your comfort. He's that worried about His glory. Jesus went to the cross for the glory of God. He went there partially motivated because he loved us. I mean, otherwise, why create this whole universe and all that sort of thing? But the primary motivation was the pleasing of the Father. What was his anguish in the garden? What was he praying about in the garden? Was he worried about if people were going to be pleased by it? What he was concerned with was the will of the Father and his ability, his desire to perform it. God's not after my comfort. He's after his glory. But God has oftentimes worked it out. That oftentimes that which is for his glory is temporarily beneficial for me too in this life. Many times. To be honest and such in the workplace. That a lot of times that works out in our society anyway. A lot of times these sorts of things work out. But his chief pursuit is not that things work out well for us, but that his name be magnified. So, secondly, he delights in this innocent one suffering, not just because of his own glory, the pursuit of that, but also since he is pursuing his glory, the microphone he will use to magnify his name is an innocent person suffering. What makes an innocent person an ideal megaphone for this? And that's what's happening here. In our text, a servant is being hurt and they've done nothing wrong. Why would that be such a good way to announce God, to magnify him? Well, I think because we have a contrast. We have what the world offers and props up and puts in front of us, and then we have what God offers. The world offers you phonies and frauds, counterfeits. Counterfeits to all the things that really matter in life. It's smoke and mirrors. God showcases truth and reality, integrity. He offers the believer the chance, the opportunity to display that there is a God. That there is a God who is alive. He's alive in me. And the trials of my life, the problems, the things that are awful, are the context in which we get to reveal that. The world is not impressed. No one is truly impressed. No person of real thought is impressed when you're joyful and everything in your life is great. When you're Taylor Swift, you know, or whoever, and you got all the money and fame and all that stuff in the world, and if they're happy, it's like, well, they should be. They got everything. Why wouldn't they be happy? But when everything is done and everything is wiped out and your life is terrible and you can sing in a prison cell like Paul, what do you do with that? How do you stop that guy? You don't. The Christian cannot be conquered, and we prove that when we are suffering unjustly, when we're going through trial and we still magnify his name and we don't crumble and we don't fade, when we stand. Right there it is. When life is upside down and you're not, that's your opportunity to magnify the Lord. See, the world offers a counterfeit, but the trials of life reveal that. They show whether you're true or false. God delights in these things because he delights to have his children do what the world cannot. We can achieve the impossible. We can have hope in the midst of despair. And our behavior when we are innocently suffering proves all of this. Proves that there is a God, that he is alive in us. And our actions are our strongest witness to the world. Now, like I said, we have these people throughout our society who've been propped up as, look how cool they are and all that stuff. And Priscilla and I were talking the other day, and I was thinking, almost everybody I can think of that was considered super cool back in the day has been revealed to, you know, for what they are. Think about this. Our sports heroes and stuff. Michael Jordan. Talked about him before. Watch his Hall of Fame speech. He's a pompous, arrogant man who among his inner circle, you know what he tells them to call him? Yahweh. You don't fall lower than that in my book. I thought he was the coolest thing since sliced bread, you know? Grew up around here, so how do you not? And he was, man, so cool. I keep going through a list. What about, remember Michael Jackson? Remember that creep? It's amazing. Once he died, everybody dropped all the stuff about him being a pedophile. He stopped talking about it. Well, he wasn't that bad. Really? He's totally creepy. Read about him a little bit if you want to be creeped out. This is a guy who changed his skin color, took hormones to make sure he had a woman voice. Always, if you aren't aware of this, if you weren't around at the time, he was always being kind of lewd in his actions. Remember how he would dance? Yeah, oh, I got a good grimace out of Carlo over there. Right? Creepy. The world propped him up as heroes, as cool people. I remember Robin Williams being super cool, too. Where are they at now? What have they been revealed to be? What does the world do with a Robin Williams? They try to run back to his sense of humor. What I do is I run to the end. I don't care how much he made me laugh. Look how he died. He had no hope in this life. And all the world can offer you is that facade of laughter, the party, with no substance. The world props up the Michael Jacksons and the Michael Jordans and the Robin Williams people. And God showcases people like Job and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, John the Baptist. I think John the Baptist would have freaked everybody out. If he was around today, we'd be scared. Just look how society reacts to the Duck Dynasty guy. Right? Whoa, my word. This guy is nuts. Of course, they've made that kind of cool now, so big beards are awesome, which I think is great, by the way. I like that. The world showcases facades. It has publicists that control your image. It has Photoshop that controls how you're seen. It has cover-up artists. And we have, in a contrast to that, we have real heroes like David. And we see all the ugliness of who he really was, as well as the upside. We have people in the Bible like Judah. Who's the man from whom he's the lineage of the great-great-great-great-grandfather of Jesus. And what is Judah known for? Well, he had a child with a woman who he thought to be a prostitute. We have Jacob. You ever do like a character study of Jacob in the Bible and come out like, man, that guy was amazing? No, you see him for all he really is, warts and all. Why? Because the point is to draw you to God, not to the guy. The world offers heroes with fake tans, bleached teeth, and makeup. Our heroes have like bedhead and acne, you know? And where's the proof? Where's the proof? How do you know, like I said, that a Michael Jackson or that a Whitney Houston or Robin Williams or whoever you can think of from former time, how do you know that they're just a facade? You see what comes out of their life when the trials of life come in, when the weightiness of life comes in. What's produced in them? What comes out of them as the fires of life test them? Child of God, you are going to suffer. All who desire to live righteously in this life will suffer. But that is not an evil for you. It is a blessing. When that comes, that is your chance, my friend, to shine. To shine. The glory of God in the face of Christ is to shine in this world. It is going to shine through us. So when it goes upside down, don't despair. Recognize that it's a divine appointment for you to showcase God. and your trust in him. So innocent suffering is something that delights God because God delights to see his children become strong in his strength. To be able to stand behind that shield of faith, to put on that helmet of salvation, to take out the sword of the Spirit, the breastplate of righteousness, and to stand. He delights to see that. And who doesn't like to see their son become a man? I love that my kids are little and I get to look at them while they're little, but I also love to see them get big and strong. I love to see them overcome, don't you? When all of a sudden you see that they're a man now, that's just got to be awesome. I am not there yet. I'm looking forward to it. But God delights to see us do what the world cannot do. I'm laboring this point because I think this is such a big issue. When you view that rightly, God delights to see the innocent suffer here, the innocent child of his suffer. I think you've got to wrestle with that issue. How could he do that? He could do that because he's after his glory and because he's after your ability to stand, to not be blown to and fro by every wave of doctrine, but to show yourself a man or a woman of God. When an innocent man is accused and attacked, like he's speaking of here in 1 Peter, and he bears it, he says here in our text that he must bear up under it. When he bears this innocent suffering beautifully, what does that communicate? It communicates that man is an oak in a field of wheat. You ever watch the wheat? You know, when it's all full grown and it gets blowing and you see it all bending over and all that stuff, and then you see a tree in the middle of that? The tree kind of stands out, doesn't it? The tree's not going anywhere. It's a rock. It communicates that there is a living God and he is among us. Again, I think the world would give you a great song and dance and a pill and a glass of wine to swallow it all down with. But God makes you able to sing in a prison cell. God makes you able to offer real hope and comfort to those who are suffering. I remember years ago, I watched, I don't know when it was, like a decade ago or something like that, I watched a Batman movie, and the boy, Bruce Banner, his parents just get killed. And the kid's right there, and he watches the whole thing happen, and then the cop comes after it's all over, and the kid's sitting there crying and shivering, and they put a blanket on him, and the cop says to him, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." I can't tell you how irritated I was. It's not okay! It's not okay! That's not the thing to say there. That's the best the world can give you as a comfort. It's okay. No, it's not. It's not okay. It's awful. The sum of all fears for a child just happened right in front of him, and all you can say, it's okay. Really? That's not what a Christian can offer. A Christian can say, like Joseph, though they meant it for evil, God meant it for good. So I can stand. We can offer real comfort to those who are in need. We don't have to give a song and dance routine. We can face the realities of cancer and of death, and we can look them in the face, and we cannot be afraid. That's what God offers. Not a facade. I often think that the world throws a better party than the Christian church because it has to. It has to. It has to keep you entertained and distracted from the realities of life. You got to throw a great party to do that. You got to make people not think about the realities. You got to distract them. You got to give them wine and song. We have a certain hope, however, beloved, that if we suffer because we are innocent, if we suffer for that, we know that we have the applause, praise, the smile of God. As verse 21 says, Christ gave us an example to follow. So now, what's the result? So now, you are to set the pattern for someone else to follow in. The illustration here of following in the footsteps, verse 21, he says, you have been called for this purpose since Christ also suffered, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. In his steps, the perfect illustration of this, I think, is the snow. When you're a kid and your dad walked through the snow, what did you do? You would hop from one footstep to the next. That's what we're supposed to do with the example of Christ. How did he suffer? How did he endure? Well, I'm going to hop in those same steps, and then I want my kids to do the same, and I want the church to do the same. And so we're setting a pace. So what we're saying is, let me show you how it's done. That's what a mature Christian is supposed to be doing, setting the pattern. I read of a guy a few years ago who, while he found out he had terminal cancer and things of that nature, he grabbed a guy at his church and he said, I want you to come see how a Christian dies. I want you to walk with me through me dying. I want you to see how I face it. That's the example that Christ left for us, and that's the example we're supposed to pass on as we mature. That's intimidating, isn't it? You see the steps of Christ, and you say, I can't get there. Well, once you get over that whole thing, you then say, well, okay, how can I get there? Verse 23 says a key thing. Let's go to verse 22 just because I want to. Who committed no sin. Jesus Christ committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. And while suffering, he uttered no threats. What's the temptation in the midst of innocently suffering? To fight. To strike back. To attack. To think that, no, I've got to do that. We want to have a self-pity parade in our brain. The antidote to that whole way of thinking is to look at Christ. If anyone should have kicked back, it would be the innocent one, Jesus Christ. If anyone should have fought, it should have been him. So in the midst of that, we consider Christ, and how did he overcome? But he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. How did the ultimate innocent one overcome the complete injustice and inhumanity of man? He didn't trust himself, even though he could have. Even though, in to the human mind, he should have. He did not entrust himself even to himself, but to the Father. That's how we get there. That's the truth we need to meditate upon. I will entrust myself to the righteous judge. If God has shown us anything in that whole back section of your Bible, is the repeated pattern of being a righteous judge. Over and over again, story after story, text after text shows us he is a righteous judge. And in part, he is right when everyone else is wrong. And I can trust that God. I can trust him. I can trust him because I can understand that I'm not omniscient and maybe I don't see what he's doing. In some ways, this is an elaboration upon the mindset that Joseph had to have when his brothers are throwing him in a pit and selling him into slavery, and then Potiphar gets him thrown in jail for nothing he did wrong. I mean, he's got to be over and over again going back to the same truth, doesn't he? I didn't do anything wrong. What's going on? I've got to trust the God who I believe in. I've got to trust him that what's happening, all this upheaval, is for a reason. And so in the end, he can say to his brothers, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. I couldn't see what God was doing. No one could have seen that. In Joseph's life, no one could have seen that coming. But God did. He had a specific plan. And what he asked Joseph is the same thing that he asked you. Trust me. Trust me with what's happening. Don't despair. Instead, shine. Manifest the glory of God in this hopeless world that gets fixed upon its distractions. I can be a submissive servant, even in the face of blatant injustice towards me. We can do that. I can do that when I know my Father is pleased with me. Think of Stephen, first Christian martyr. What did he do wrong? He told people the truth. He told the people of Israel the truth, and they hated him for it. Turn over there real quick. This is what we'll close with. Acts 7. Acts chapter 7. Verse 54. Oh, man, I got to back up. Verse 52, which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become when you killed Jesus Christ. You received the law as ordained by angels, and yet you did not keep it. Hellfire and brimstone sermon right there. And when they heard this, they were cut to the quick, cut to the heart, and they began gnashing their teeth at him. And being full of the Holy Spirit, Stephen gazed intently into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And he said, behold, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. This is how Stephen could say, Father, forgive them. Even though they were murdering him for telling them what they desperately needed to hear. An innocent man bludgeoned to death with rocks can say, Father, forgive. Why? Because he was a submissive servant who knew he had the approval of his God. What a powerful thing that is. It's exactly what Hebrews says when we see him who is unseen. We live as though the unseen God were right here. How is it that Stephen could do this? How is it that we can do this? Because we can look to heaven and see his smile. Isn't that what you live for, Christian? Isn't that the whole thing for you? God, saying, way to go. My son, my child, you have done what the world cannot do. What an awesome chance and opportunity that is ours. When suffering comes, seize that opportunity, my friend. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank you that we can entrust ourselves to you, that we can believe you and trust you in the midst of trial and heartache. Father, make us strong in the strength of your might. May we show ourselves to be men and women of God. In Jesus' name.